everyone, and welcome back to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Nisch. I'm a earth scientist, a planetary geologist, and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores, a professor of space engineering at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, and just a big speculative fiction nerd, when you get right down to it. This week, we have one of my choices. And I decided, since in the last season we did Blade Runner, that I wanted to do sort of the anti-Blade Runner. And for that, I picked The Fifth Element from 1997. So where Blade Runner is, you know, dark and atmospheric, this film is bright, it's colorful, it's loud, and if you don't mind me saying so, very, very French. Story is a simple one. Every 5,000 years or so, there is a great mysterious evil that threatens all life in the universe. The only defense is a weapon made up of the five elements, earth, wind, fire, water, and the fifth element, an engineered Quodimark's perfect being, played by Mila Jovovich.
Okay, General, I want to show you something here. This is a normal human DNA chain, okay? You, me, anybody, right? Watch this. The compositional elements of his DNA chain are the same as ours. There's simply more of them, tightly packed with infinite genetic knowledge, almost like this being was engineered.
Is there any danger?
No. We put it through the cellular hygiene detector. The cell is, for lack of a better word, perfect.
As the story opens in the 23rd century, the evil has arrived again, and the forces of good must assemble together. All the five elements. Fortunately, they have several skilled characters on their side, including Corbin Dallas, who's played by Bruce Willis. He's a skilled ex-military cab driver. We've got Ruby Rod, played by Chris Tucker, a famous and completely unforgettable radio host and DJ. And we also have Ian Holm, playing the priest Cornelius. The casting is fantastic in this film, and they're opposed by a corporate titan, Jean-Baptiste Emmanuel Zorg, so nice they named him four times. That's Gary Oldman, and he is clad throughout the movie in his most fashionable Third Reich meek surf style getup. The costumes. Oh my goodness, the costumes, Catherine.
Yes, that is unforgettable, for sure. I remember seeing this in the theaters in the 90s. I don't think I've watched it since. The experience was much different than watching it again now in 2025.
It does feel different, doesn't it?
I remember it being very weird when I was a teenager watching this in the 90s. And now it just sort of seems, I don't know, immature and goofy. It doesn't seem as weird as I remember. I don't know. How did you feel watching this again after such a long time between when it was released?
Oh, I feel like my response is, you know, can't it be both?
I guess.
Because the immature thing, I get that. One thing, and we'll talk about this more later on, is this was a film and a universe and a story that was written by the director when he was still a teenage boy. And it kind of feels like that,
yeah.
I have to say.
Yeah. I mean, I think I didn't notice it the first time because I myself was a teenage girl. But watching it now as a 40-something-year-old woman, I definitely noticed the immaturity inherent in the story and the characters.
100%. I didn't see this one in theaters. I saw it, I think, on video a little bit later on. But I remember really enjoying the soundtrack, actually, that Eric Serra does.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the music. I actually did a bit of a deep dive into the Diva Dance song that we're going to talk about later, too. Yeah, but all throughout, the music was really wonderful. And it kind of changed styles to match the mood, which I appreciated.
It is nice that way, and it doesn't get in the way of things, which is a little bit nice. And that's another parallel with Blade Runner, right, which has that iconic score to it. After I rewatched the movie again, I had a very different experience watching the movie as, you know, a 40-some-year-old person. I remember, I think, messaging you and saying, oh my goodness, there is no science shine in this whatsoever. It is all science gripes. I had a hard time.
I can find science shine anywhere. You have to be a bit creative.
And you did.
Yeah. I mean, certainly I would not say that's its strength, and I was reaching perhaps in parts, but you know, there's always something good to be found in any movie. Maybe accidentally put there.
True. But it is a little bit different, right? Like, we've seen things that don't care about the science. We've seen plenty of movies like that, like maybe Star Wars. And we've seen ones that are more like, you know, science fantasy, like maybe Star Trek. We've seen ones that try really hard to do it. And in some cases do it really badly, like The Core.
Mm-hmm.
This one feels a little bit different. It's like they include a lot of sciencey things, but they don't care about them. And so the stuff that they pull in feels like it's just there as techno babble, basically.
Yeah, right. I agree. It reminds me of Star Trek in that way, where they would just kind of insert sciencey sounding words to make it sound sciencey. I don't know. Like, that was as far as their thought process went, I think. I don't think they really cared about the science. They just wanted it to sound cool. So in that regards, it reminds me of like the Star Trek techno babble for sure. No, I agree. This one's a bit of a weird one in how little they seem to care about the science.
Absolutely. And at least we knew on Star Trek that they talked to scientists when they were creating the techno babble. Here, I don't think they did that.
No, they couldn't have. Some of the things they said are just bizarre. Like, where did they even come up with these words? No scientist would, in their right mind, would allow them to say that.
So I've got to ask, Catherine, what is the most offensive piece of science damage that you found in this one?
Probably the most baffling is that scene when they're reviving the fifth element in the nuclear labs, and they're describing her DNA and how she's structured. And the whole scene is just wrong from start to finish. Starting with, they describe human beings as having 40 DNA memo groups. And I was like, what's a memo group? Is this some like biology term I've never heard of? But no, it's just technobabble. It doesn't mean anything. The best I could think of is maybe they were referring to chromosomes, because we do have 46 chromosomes, but that's not 40, and it's not a memo group. And then they talk about her having 200,000 memo groups, but if that's chromosomes, you don't want 200,000 chromosomes, right? Like, famously humans get diseases when they have extra chromosomes. So that whole scene was baffling. The fact that they could reconstruct her from just a few cells, like all they had, they bring her in and it's just her hand clutching a box that I later realized was the box to the four stones, the four elements. But that's all they have to work with. And they reconstruct her from her hand, essentially, which is also, how in the world do you do that, right? I mean, yes, I know it's the 23rd century, but that seems like a bit of a stretch. And then this whole emphasis on her being perfect and having perfect cells, what does that even mean? What's a perfect cell? Like, isn't any cell perfect if it works? So I don't know. I did not like that scene. I found it confusing and really didn't help me understand what was going on with her. So I don't know. What did you think of that scene, John?
Oh, it's terribly confusing and really strange. Not only are they able to reconstruct her from her hand, but apparently her DNA also encodes her memory.
Oh, and, that's right. Language.
You know, tattoos and stuff like that. Exactly. She's able to explain how she died and all the circumstances around it, as if that's being stored in every cell in her body, which seems like a poor choice.
The tattoo, I might give them a pass because it is on her wrist. So it's possible that tattoo survived, but the rest of it is just nonsense.
It's also a little weird. They have a machine that sort of extrudes bits of her and then they get sliced into chunks and then moved around with a robotic arm. And I'm here thinking, if they can actually like extrude her body straight up, why don't they just do that, right? Rather than this sort of, you know, polystyrene version, like from 3D printing from decades ago. So a little bit bizarre. And the skin thing.
I agree. Yeah. They imply that you could just generate skin by exposing somebody to UV and the body will just magically invent skin to protect itself from the UV, which is just nonsense. So silly.
Well, fortunately, she's not human, right?
But she looks exactly like a human, which was the other thing I didn't like, right? I mean, she's essentially an alien. Why does she look so human-like and act like a human? I mean, maybe there's some reason for that because they invented her to protect Earth. I don't know. I mean, they weren't trying, right? They just wanted some hot young lady to play this role. That was as far as their thought process went, I think.
Well, thankfully, she's got some thermal bandages to keep her warm.
Yeah. That somehow all link together too, right? Like when they show them putting the bandages on, they're just like throwing straps across her body, but then magically they're all hooked up together so they can't fall off of her and just very conveniently cover all the, you know, naughty bits that you would want covered up. Yeah, that was pretty funny. But, you know, I actually liked the costumes, so I won't give them too much of a hard time. The costumes were kind of wild and I appreciated that.
It's true. It is eye-catching. And I have to say that scene, you know, when she's escaping that lab and jumping into traffic, that's pretty iconic from the late 90s, I think. You know, that overhead view.
Right. This was another gripe I had, is that she, A, can drop into a cab and not die. I don't know how far that drop was, but it was
a long way.
Probably 100 meters at least. Yeah. or that she could even puncture the cab roof. I mean, unless it was made of cardboard, you would just dent the roof and die. You wouldn't puncture through the roof and survive. There's actually a cool YouTube video I found where this guy, I think he wants to be the new Mythbusters guy. And so he took dummies. Uh-huh. He taped something to them that would monitor how many G's they experienced, how much gravity they experienced when they were dropped, and then dropped them in different positions onto different parts of the car to see if they would survive. And no, this poor dummy didn't survive any of the drops, nor did they crack the top of the roof, unless it was a sunroof. But Bruce Willis's cab did not seem like it had a sunroof. So yeah, she wouldn't crack the top of the taxi and she would die in the process. So that was another thing. I know she's a perfect being or whatnot, but gravity will mess you up.
Oh yeah. And here we have the flying cars. This is one of the most interesting representations of it, because I think a lot of the films where we've seen it, you see these isolated flying cars. Not here. This is like Futurama level, New York City, three-dimensional, like gridlock and congestion. And it's just absolutely bonkers. Like, can you believe that they let human beings drive in that?
It seemed horribly unsafe, right? Yeah, you have to be so careful when you're operating in three dimensions. And there were just cars everywhere. Like when they were diving down to like escape the cops.
Yes.
You know, it's amazing they didn't hit anything. And I think Bruce Willis alluded to that, because they were headed for the fog layer to hide from the cops. And so they're dodging all these cars on the way down. But why is there a fog layer in New York City, John? Where's that come from? Why would it be there? I didn't understand that at all.
Yeah, the best I can figure is this is a throwback to something like Blade Runner that has that miasma near the surface. Mm. I mean, you can get stuff like that, like these ground fogs, but at least where we've built up cities, they tend to retain heat, they tend to dissipate this stuff. And so you actually find less fog in built-up areas these days, typically. Now, we've not tried to build a city like, you know, New York in the 2300s, or sorry, the 23rd century, but it is not really lending itself to that. I mean, maybe it's photochemical smog, but you still need to generate that with sunlight. And it doesn't look like much sunlight gets down there.
No, no. And then the other wild thing is you actually get a wide view of New York City as they're blasting off to go to the Flotsam Paradise. And A, there's no fog layer that you can see. And the other really eye-catching thing is that the sea level has dropped dramatically. Mm. So New York City turns into like a Grand Canyon, essentially. The bridges are up so high, the Statue of Liberty juts out. They also have to explain why suddenly the Earth lost all this water, that sea level would drop by hundreds of meters. They don't mention it in the movie, but I think I read online that the idea is maybe they were like exporting the water off-world to help terraform other planets. But I don't know, that'd be a heck of a lot of water you'd have to get rid of to turn New York City into a canyon.
Must be those aliens. They're always coming here for our water. Maybe they finally got some.
That's right. But I was reading some posts about this on Reddit, and they're like, do they really want the water from the Hudson? Right? You know, some of the most polluted water on Earth.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm so tempted to say, you know, about the traffic that we were talking about, that the most unrealistic thing is the fact that it was moving in New York City.
Yeah, right. So yeah, New York City in the future, probably not going to look like that. I actually read another sci-fi book about New York in the future by Kim Stanley Robinson. And there he actually...
I know this one.
Yeah. He assumes it's actually going to get flooded. So everyone's going to like be boating around New York City. So it's the opposite, which honestly seems more realistic, right? As we warm up the world and the ice caps melt, sea level's more likely to rise than to fall.
It was interesting in that one that people stayed in the towers, right, and still traveled between them rather than abandoning the city.
Yeah, it was cool. Anyways, what's that book called? It's like it's a year, right, John? Do you remember?
Is it 2041?
2140. Okay, that makes more sense. Yeah.
Wrong order of numbers.
Yeah, I was like 2040. That just seems too close to now to be realistic. Should we talk about the Death Sphere?
Oh, I think that's not a bad idea. What really irked you about this? I know what irked me.
Oh, when we first see the Death Sphere?
Yeah, when it's sitting out there in space. And
they're like shooting laser guns at it, that part?
Yeah. And it's doing other stuff. You know, it's there's loads to talk about with Mr. Shadow.
Is Mr. Shadow the Death Sphere, or is he like an alien who lives in the Death Sphere? This was also unclear to me.
It does change name a few times, doesn't it, in the movie?
Well, the first thing that really bothered me was that it just like... increased in volume and presumably mass whenever they shot at it. So unless evil has a mass, I don't know where all this mass is coming from. It seems to violate, you know, the principles of conservation of mass. So that was not great. And then later on, it's like sucking up satellites for some reason. I don't know how it did that. Does it have some crazy magnetic field? I don't know. I don't know what's going on. Maybe it's intelligent and oh gosh knows. I mean, clearly they were not thinking. I'm thinking way harder about this than they were.
The crazy thing with the satellites is that, okay, like when I first watched the movie, I was thinking, okay, where are these coming from? Is it pulling them at more than light speed in from other planets and stuff like that? But after I read your comments, the thing that really struck me was that if it has the capability to suck in all of these satellites, you know, something magnetic, then, you know, radio is electromagnetic waves. Why doesn't it just communicate with the giant magnet thing? Right? Because apparently that can go over long distances.
I thought they were trying to disrupt communication on Earth. So they were sucking up all our communication satellites so we couldn't talk to each other. Maybe I misunderstood that.
Oh. I thought it was because Mr. Shadow wanted to make a call and needed, you know, like access to the phone network or something.
No, he seemed able to just emit radio waves, right? There's that one scene where he's making the call to Zorg. And the whole like death planet is like vibrating with radio waves, I assume.
I thought that was after the satellite.
I don't know. The other thing about the death sphere that was not great was its size. So they explicitly say it's 1,200 miles in diameter, which is about the size of Pluto, to give you a sense of how big that is. But then as it's flying through the solar system, every time I see it, it seems to be a different size. Like when it flies past Saturn, just a quick glance looks like it's about the size of Saturn's ring, which is huge, which is like 30,000 kilometers wide. And then when it gets to Earth, maybe it looks like the size of the moon, which is about twice that size. So they clearly were not being very consistent with how big the death sphere was. And then at the very end, you know, they blast it with their love ray, whatever it is, and it stops short. It stops short right there at the exact limit of space, the von Karman line, which is 100 kilometers up, which is not a scientifically useful number. It's just legally that's where we've defined space to be. But it's kind of meaningless because the atmosphere just slowly gets less and less dense. There is no like real place where you can say space definitively begins. It's a very tenuous line. But they must have heard that number somewhere because they set it at exactly that line. That's where it stops. And then it just hovers over the Earth, right? And maybe this goes along with all the other examples of anti-gravity we saw throughout the movie, you know, the flying cabs, you know, when they transport the fifth element around, there's anti-gravity. So is this thing just like held up by anti-gravity? Like, why doesn't it just continue to fall into the Earth? Is it orbiting it? But then you'd get some wicked effects from tides. I don't know. Like, that whole ending was not great.
It's a bad day for the Earth, no matter what happens, you know, with something that big, that close. And there's gravity problems, there's tidal problems. There's potentially having it fall the remaining tiny 62 miles compared to its size problems. That shadow thing drives me nuts. The fact that as it gets close, you can see its shadow and you can see the sun in the same shot.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, so this thing is like descending towards the Earth and it's casting a shadow on the temple where they've set up the fifth element. And you can, like John said, you can clearly see the sun to the side. It's like setting. and the sphere is not between the temple and the sun. It's just coming straight down. Yeah. Not great. Geometry doesn't work.
Oh, it's absolutely nuts. But you would expect people who are directors of photography to know this, if nothing else.
Again, maybe evil has both mass and a way of turning out the lights. It's just magic. Evil can do anything.
The law of conservation of evil.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I did love that. And then, as I've read online, and I think you brought this up too, like, where are all the other death spheres from the past 5,000 years ago when this presumably also happened, right? Are they just like wandering around the solar system and we haven't seen them yet? Unclear. Unclear.
Definitely. Well, as is always fun, and we'll talk about this more when we get to the its time section, there's always things in these movies that they don't change that's weird. In this movie, I thought it was interesting that there's a few things that they changed a little bit, but in ways that were really kind of strange, even from a scientific perspective, like the fact that apparently we've gone back in time from the 1990s and now have mail delivered by pneumatic tubes. So my guess as to why New York City has to be as big as it is because it's like 95% pneumatic tubes to deliver that mail.
That's
all
right.
Over the place.
Again, yeah, it's very Futurama like. But Futurama was making fun of the future, right? Whereas this one, I think, tries to take itself a little bit more seriously.
The other thing that it does and it portrays, which is again, like, I think, you know, back to the past. It's like over time, we've actually been getting better to one another. We're having fewer conflicts and fewer wars. It may not seem like it, but it is improving over what it used to be. And even, you know, in terms of crime and whatnot, things are, you know, with some stops in the line, things are getting better. And this society depicted in The Fifth Element is incredibly violent.
Yes.
Like the number of weapons that that Corbin Dallas has, the fact that the police are willing to just open up on his cab and, you know, shoot it down so that it falls through like all this active traffic.
Oh, I didn't consider
like,
that.
Oh my goodness.
That's I hadn't considered if their cab anti-gravity failed, they would have like crushed so many other people below them. Yeah.
I mean, on the earth today, there's a lot of police departments that have a policy of not chasing vehicles because it puts other people at risk.
Well, that's this what he said, too. He said, if they don't chase you past a mile, they're not going to chase you. Right. So I guess that is kind of understood within New York City, but they really wanted that Fifth Element. So they kept chasing him.
Oh, goodness. And then, of course, you know, the trouble with the train. Why is there a train?
Oh, you mean they're like when they're dodging around the different vehicles trying
like
to escape?
Got to be on the 300th floor or something. This train is coming along.
So, yeah, it was all pretty silly. I mean, when you start looking into the details, there's so many of them that are wrong. Like they use a temperature scale that has no meaning. They said the temperature sensors were returning values from a million to -5,000, but there's no temperature scale that uses values like that, right? Absolute zero is -273 Celsius. So nothing goes down to -5,000, although sometimes it feels like that in southwestern Ontario.
And the people that make thermometers and make, you know, temperature sensing instruments know this. I don't know. It feels like we're almost being cruel, Catherine. Before we leave the science gripes, is there anything else you want to pick at?
Oh my gosh. I have a huge long list here. I wonder. Okay, there is one thing. Now, this isn't a science thing. It's more of an economics thing. But Zorg makes this big point about how destruction is good for the economy. How he smashes a glass and then all these little robots come and clean it up. And he's like, oh, you know, I'm feeding the people who developed these robots and built them because I'm making them useful. But this is actually a fallacy. It's called the parable of the broken window. And so indeed, let's say, you know, you're a shopkeeper and some kid throws a rock through your window and now you've got a broken window. You've got to fix it, right? So indeed, you're helping the window maker, right? You're giving him a couple of bucks to fix the window. But it's not like you're generating new business, right? You would have spent that money elsewhere. Maybe you would have bought a new book or replaced an old refrigerator or something, right? You would have spent that money, but now you have to spend it on the window. So it's not like you're generating new business. You're just directing it in one particular direction. So he makes this big point about that's why he does what he does, because he's helping out. But it's wrong. And I guess this is known, right? It's actually a French essay from 1850. So you'd think Luc Besson would have heard about it, but I guess not.
Well, maybe a little bit of l'esprit de l'escalier there. Let's go ahead and invoke the mercy rule for the Fifth Element. And we'll be right back in a minute with the science shine. Welcome back. We're going to talk about the science shine, the things that we liked that this film had in it. And like I was saying, when I talked to Catherine, I'm like, I can't find anything in this one. But ever the optimist, Catherine managed to find a little bit of light peeking in around the door.
Aziz, light!
What did you really like? Yes, indeed.
Which actually was
I walked
one
right
of,
into that.
Which, which was one of my signs, shine, right? So at the very beginning of the movie, they're in this this temple. It's quite dark. They don't, it's 1914, so they don't have flashlights or anything like that. So the scientist has employed a young Arab boy to take a reflective mirror. And so he's shining the light from the entrance of the temple to the hieroglyphs on the wall that he's studying. And this is, you know, it's kind of a clever design, right? You just reflect the light that you're getting to see what you need to see. So yeah, I mean, as a very, you know, quick and easy, simple science shine, I thought that was pretty neat.
Yeah, it's a nice little thing that they do get right.
And in terms of influence, which we'll talk about later, I still feel like people say Aziz light, you know, as something in the common cultural understanding of this movie.
That's true.
So when I mentioned I was doing this movie with my children, they're like, well, what is the fifth element? And now this isn't really science shine, but it's boron. So it's an element that's characterized by 5 protons. It's not an element you see too often. It's a weird, brittle, dark, lustrous metalloid. But that's what the fifth element actually is. But the reason they named this movie The Fifth Element is because in early humanity, people thought that there were only 4 elements. There aren't like 200 of them as we now know. As John mentioned, those are earth, water, fire, and air. And then later, ether or space. That was actually the fifth element, not Mila Jovovich. So yes, this was commonly understood among scientists as these were the 4 elements that made up all of matter on Earth. And it only was superseded by the more modern atomic theory at the end of the 18th century. So our understanding of elements is actually pretty new. For most of human history, people did think it was kind of lumped into these broader categories. Anyways, I know they didn't actually talk about this at all in the movie, but just, you know, I thought it was kind of a cool bit of scientific history they incorporated.
Oh yeah, and it's that's kind of the level that I think I was at for Science Shine. Like they have the 4 classic Greek elements. It's like, yes, those are real things. They actually existed. They're not being used correctly, but they're real and they existed. And you get the bit, like you say, with the fifth element, you know, quintessence or ether, that's used to describe the perfect celestial sphere. So you've got that connection there with this perfection idea, at least in the past. And one of the fun things I think with ether is that of all of the 5 Greek elements, ether actually survived the longest as an actual
thing. That's true. Right. Yeah.
It's only when you get to the Michelson-Morley experiment that it was realized that the vacuum of space doesn't actually contain some ether substance through which things travel.
That's right. So that was maybe 100 years after they discovered the law of multiple proportions, that compounds all seem to have ratios of whole numbers. And that's how they kind of figured out that they were made up of different elements. But that was around the turn of the 19th century. And I think the Michelson-Morley experiment was at the end of the 19th century. Is that right? Am I remembering that? Yeah.
Yeah, that's the timeline I remember too.
Yeah. So that's an interesting point, right? So anyways, some cool science history that they're calling back to. And then we see the aliens. How do you say that? Mondashewan? They're like big, bulky aliens.
With little heads.
And I thought maybe they were wearing spacesuits. Because they kind of look like spacesuits. They would have to have really tiny heads to fit in those tiny helmets. But if they're coming from another planet, you know, you'd want to have a spacesuit on Earth, right? You might not breathe their atmosphere. So that might be a good approach. However, they seem to wear them everywhere. They never take them off. They don't change much over 300 years. So maybe that is their body. Maybe those aren't spacesuits. But, you know, if they are spacesuits, that seems like a correct thing to do if you're visiting another planet. So I will give them some points for that. You can see I'm really reaching here.
We're doing our best. And sometimes you see this trope in science fiction of people that look humanoid, but they're actually being sort of walled out from inside by a smaller alien, right? So maybe the Mondashewans are actually
like
little
Trill
spaceships.
Not quite.
Maybe. Not quite. Like the idea that somebody can almost sit inside them, like, you know, something that's
a
foot tall.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So they're like really
like a spaceship.
Tiny, like. Yeah. Okay. That's fun. Apparently they destroyed most of those outfits. There's only like a handful left on Earth because they were just like, just put them in the thresher, basically. I don't know why. They're really cool outfits.
Definitely. And apparently the sort of shuffling gait that they have has to do with the actors. It wasn't something they asked them to do, but the suits were so bulky and the suits were so hot that this is the only way they could move around.
Well, I liked it. It was a cool aesthetic, even if it was because they were torturing the actors inside the costumes. We should probably talk about language too. So Luc Besson invented Lilu's language, the divine language, I think they call it. And it only has 400 words. So I looked it up. I was trying to figure out, is this like normal for a natural language? It turns out it's not. The Oxford English Dictionary has about 273,000 head words in it. So that would be like eat and then eating, ate. You know, those are all like sub words from the head word eat. And so it's got, you know, hundreds of thousands of words in it, whereas Lilu's language only had 400 words. However, there are a couple of constructed languages people have made. So there was one called Tokipona, which was created by Canadian translator Sonia Lang with the stated purpose of simplifying her thoughts and communication. So she just invented a language that she wanted to use. There's also some languages that are used for sort of ritualistic purposes that only have a couple hundred words. So while no natural languages only has 400 words, you can see maybe some ritualistic language they might have come up with for the use of the fifth element could have something like 400 words. It's not unreasonable.
Are you multilingual, Catherine?
I am not. Are you?
I have French immersion from, you know, when I was very young. So I've got about 12 or 13 years of that. And one thing that I love about language is that the way you think about things is completely different as you move from language to language. Just the framing of the world. And it's fun to see that, at least fun to me, to see that intersect. So for instance, the other language that I speak is French. I like to be able to watch films, you know, and listen to the soundtrack, but also see the translation, because sometimes you can get a little bit more comedy from that, as, you know, you have people trying to make that paradigm shift. Fascinatingly, with this particular movie, this is a completely French production. It's just that it was so expensive that they felt they would never make their money back if they didn't have English stars and shoot it in English. But behind the scenes, you know, it must have been an interesting experience to be on set, I think, from a language perspective.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, presumably it was written originally in French, right? If it was written by a French boy as a teenager, you know, translating those ideas into English. Yeah. No, I think it was interesting how they played around with language, although that might have caused some problems in Luc Besson's marriage. In order to teach Mila Jovovich the language, they would like talk to each other and write letters to each other, which turned into a romance, which ended his marriage. So we'll maybe talk about that later too. So another thing I picked up is that they were implementing planetary protection. So that's the idea that you don't want to like transmit life around the galaxy, right? So we do this with our own spacecraft. We sterilize them before we send them to Mars or Titan or whatever planet we're sending them to. And so there's this scene when they're about to head off to Flotsam Paradise where they actually take all the parasites out of the landing gear. They look more like little...
Fraggle Rock.
Yeah. They look like Muppets. They were flame grilling. There on the tarmac. So they did that. I also noticed this very distinct scene as they're going to meet the fifth element in the nuclear labs, that they clearly go through a UV room. I don't know what else to call it, because they all lit up as you would under ultraviolet light. And so I was wondering if the idea of that was that they were trying to like remove any pathogens from the people before they entered the lab, you know, like we'd put on a bunny suit nowadays to avoid transmitting viruses and pathogens around. But maybe that was the futuristic version of that, where they just bathed everyone in UV light.
It could be. I mean, it's hard to distinguish it because it's very visually striking to use the black light, right? And it seems like at least in the future, people wear things that are very reactive to black light, and it lets them get out that line about being a freak of nature, right? Yeah, I do like that. I think I'm willing to give you that that's what was happening there.
I mean, they didn't try to explain it. I think you're right. It was just for the cool visual, but you know, I'll give them a little bit of credit for that, for thinking of that. The other thing which I alluded to earlier that I thought was pretty cool was the Diva Dance song performed by Luc Besson's wife at the time, but it was not sung by her. It was sung by a soprano, Inva Mula. And so the first part of that song is just an aria, so normal music that people would perform for an opera. But then it switches into something a little bit more futuristic, a little bit faster. And this is music that was written by the composer, Eric Serra, which he purposely or maybe not purposely made so that a regular human being probably could not sing it. There are like huge jumps, you know, more than an octave jump that he was expecting the singer to do, which is extremely difficult, if not impossible, for a human to do. Just the way our vocal cords are constructed. I actually watched a couple of YouTube videos of people attempting this song. Most of them did have to tweak the notes a little bit in order to do it. But there was one woman who got really close to singing this. So, you know, the opera singers are like, we can't sing this? Well, hold my beer. So in the movie, though, it is parts of it are digitized. So basically the singer sang the individual notes and they digitized them together. And you can hear this, right? It's clearly not being sung by a human. But then I thought, well, maybe that's realistic, right? Because the diva is not a human. So maybe aliens can sing in different ways that humans cannot. Birds sing in a weird way compared to humans. They have more than one vocal cord, so they can chirp two sounds at once. So there's precedent for this on Earth, that maybe different species would have different vocal cords that could allow them to sing in different ways that a human could not. But again, maybe I'm giving them too much credit, but that was still a really cool scene, and the music is pretty fantastic.
Definitely. And I think that's something that we do see in the animal world, right? We have animals with more senses than us, able to see more colors, for instance, in some cases less colors. And you can imagine communication being different than the way that we communicate, you know, like you've mentioned with the birds having a couple of different sounds that they can make at once. This seems totally within the realm of what biology could produce if it wanted to produce, you know, something capable of singing that song.
Yeah, yeah. And just a random thought I had when I was rewatching this last night, I noticed that the diva has all these pipes coming out of her body, and I wondered if they maybe worked like an organ pipe, you know, to play different tones. But that's just me speculating on how she made that happen.
Just makes me think of the Blue Man Group.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that makeup had to be hard to wear. Yikes. I guess she took the role because the original person who was supposed to play it never showed up. So she kind of had to be a pinch hitter there at the last minute.
Yeah, a lot of the costumes, I think, were difficult that way. I remember hearing that Chris Tucker's costumes actually had a lot of, you know, metal and heavy stuff in them.
Were, I believe it.
Very difficult. Yeah.
Yeah, but they were wonderful. Honestly, he's probably the best part of this movie in a lot of ways.
Well, it's interesting that we're talking about the refuse generated by the movie, you know, the costumes that were not kept and whatnot, because they also show this side of the future where not all our problems are solved.
Right.
And there's still this question of environmental damage. There's so much single-use culture in this. I mean,
yes.
Corbin Dallas doesn't live in a very nice place, but apparently he's only using his bed, you know, for one night, and then there's a new one underneath the shrink wrap for him. And then we see a garbage strike. So, sorry, New Yorkers, there are still garbage strikes in the future. I mean, there's just so much of this that's going on. You know, I like your idea here of thinking that it's us who are the problem. We bring the evil with us where we go.
Well, right. And the other, okay, not talking about environmental waste, but like, why did Zorg agree to help Mr. Shadow to begin with? Like, I guess he was just trying to make some money, but he was going to destroy the Earth in the process, which would not have profited him, right? So like, the evil wouldn't have gotten what they wanted if Zorg hadn't helped them. So again, the problem is just a human, right? It's not this evil ball of gunk in the sky. It's the humans causing the problems on Earth through their greed and their waste and whatnot. So that was an interesting thing that film grappled with.
True. And the problem of waste and garbage piled up in the streets is not the only place. It's also in our arteries, too, because you can see that McDonald's is still around.
Yeah, yeah. So that's in the first, I don't know, 15 minutes of the movie, there's some cops pulling up to order their Happy Meal, essentially, from this whatever 100-story McDonald's. And when they're flying through New York, getting chased by the cops, you actually see a truck carrying McDonald's equipment or whatnot. And this took me a while, but I did manage to see that it said 65 trillion served. So this was a thing McDonald's used to do. Outside of every restaurant, it would be like 500 million burgers sold. So, and they would keep updating it. They stopped this, I don't know, 20 years ago, something like that, when they got over a billion and they wanted to stop counting. So now it just says billions and billions served. But I wanted to do some math to see that based on how many burgers people eat today, if they could have sold 65 trillion by the year 2260 or whenever this movie is supposed to take place, because they're also not very clear about that point. There's some conflicting numbers, but I'm going to use 2257 because that is the number that's listed on the DVD box. And there's actually a cool site you can go to that shows you how many burgers McDonald's sells every minute, and apparently sells 75 burgers a second. And I found an article that said in 2013, they sold their 300 billionth hamburger. So if they maintained a constant rate, I'm just going to make that assumption, people keep eating McDonald's burgers at the same rate, you would have sold about 0.9 trillion. So it's not 65 5 trillion, but we're getting there. And maybe burger consumption goes up in the future. Who knows? But it's not an unreasonable number that they picked 65 trillion based on how many burgers people eat today.
And there's 200 billion people on Earth in the fifth element.
Oh, that's right. And I forgot about that. Who knows? Yeah. 200 billion people.
Maybe there are locations elsewhere, you know, in the universe, you know.
Fair enough.
This fine product.
Fair enough. You can get your Big Mac on Flotsam Paradise.
I think we might be through
A
lot of the science.
What
shine.
Little we could pull out of it, yeah.
Is there anything else you want to cover before we go on to the of its time?
No, there is one thing. Actually,
I think the of its time is going to be
Fun. Yeah. There's one thing that I really liked when this robber comes to steal from Bruce Willis. He actually has a picture of the hallway on his head that he points towards the door so Bruce Willis can't see that he's out there. I thought that was very clever and kind of a fun scene. So I will give them props for that.
It is. It just, I don't know. It just seems so stupid.
I know, but it's clever, right? It's clever. If you're trying to rob somebody, you don't want them to see you out in the hallway when they're opening the door. I liked it.
Fair. All right. Well, we will stop it there and we'll be back in just a minute with Of Its Time. Okay, welcome back. So this story that we see in The Fifth Element was conceived in 75 when the director, Luc Besson, was 16. And we had the production in the mid-90s in 95, starting in August. And then we got this release in 1997. So that's sort of, the time period that's involved here. And there are definitely things in this one that place it where it is in time.
Oh, for sure.
What was the real obvious thing for you, Catherine?
Well, it's just silly that they said the 23rd century would look essentially like the 1990s, right? They had telephones. They had paper mail. It just, I don't know. Like, they just were not very creative about what they thought the future was going to look like. Like, already in 2025, nobody has proper phones anymore. Mail is a thing of the past. The giant CRT monitors. They have the phone book. He looked up the priest in the phone book.
Yes.
I haven't seen a phone book in decades, right? So they just weren't very clever about how they thought the future was going to look.
My favorite piece of that is when Zorg is choking in his office and he's trying to get his technology to help him. He has this numeric keypad that he uses for everything. And one of the things is he's just randomly punching buttons that flies out of his desk is all of these CDs. I mean, maybe they're priceless historical artifacts.
Right.
But they don't look like they're being kept that way.
No. Yeah. They even make a reference to The Lion King, which already seems kind of out of date, it was just very firmly placed in the 90s. I wish they'd been a little bit more creative about how they saw the future.
You're just missing the 2256 reboot of the series.
Yeah, I don't even want to know what that's going to look like. The other thing I thought very much placed it in the 90s were just the actors, right? Like, Bruce Willis was in every action movie in the 90s, right? I was talking to my husband and he called this like space Die Hard, which it kind of is, right? It's Die Hard with blonde tips, It's
thankfully he's got shoes.
Yeah. I mean, he's even got the tank top on, right? It's orange this time, not white.
True.
Yeah. So apparently Bruce Willis really enjoyed this film. He actually was not originally supposed to do it because the production had been delayed so long and he was going to be working on another film. And Besson just called him just to chat, told him that they were going to go ahead with The Fifth Element and that they'd have to go with, another actor because they had limited funds. And Willis was like, well, if I like the film, maybe we can come to an arrangement. And agreed to take the role for a lower cost because I guess he just enjoyed the movie so much. Gary Oldman was a different story. I think he did it as a favor to the director who had helped him with another of his films and apparently quite hated the movie after the fact. So, different people had different perspectives on this.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that's happened, I think, with the movie over time is it's become a bit of a cult classic, even though it was quite successful in its day. So I notice for me, it sort of had that kind of quality. And there are other little things that you found here out on the internet. Mm-hmm. And it seems like we're not the first people to be upset with the science of this one either. It's a lot of people seem to think it's in that sort of so bad it's good kind of category.
Right, right. It was listed as one of the 20 best worst science fiction movies of all time. So yeah, more of the cult classic than a classic classic. But on the other hand, it was listed as number 42 on 100 best sci-fi movies. So it seems like there is not consensus on this point. I think it depends on, you know, where you're coming to the movie from. You know, are you looking for just a goofy, fun ride? Then yeah, it's a fine movie. But if you want to take yourself a little bit more seriously, then there are some issues, you know. You've gotta look at. I was shocked to learn that it actually premiered at the Cannes Film Festival in May of 1997, right? I always think of Cannes as like this, you know, artistic movie experience and not like a goofy action thriller like The Fifth Element. But yeah, they went all out. They were given a special Fifth Element watch, which was your ticket to get into the movie. There was a futuristic ballet, a fashion show by the designer Jean-Paul Gaultier, and fireworks. So they really, yeah, went all in at Cannes for this movie, which surprised me.
Yeah, I think the first film at Cannes, the one that opens the festival, is always something commercial and big. And this one was the biggest production that France had ever seen.
It's true.
So I think this one actually makes sense, right? Something for the industry and for the people who participated, even if maybe it's not likely to be a big awards performer.
Yeah, I was also surprised to learn that it was the highest grossing French film at the international box office until 2011, which is when The Untouchables was released. So yeah, for 15 years, it was the highest grossest French film. It made $263 million US. So that was pretty good since it only had a $90 million budget. So, I mean, it was a success in a lot of ways. And, you know, and it's fine. It's still fine to watch today, despite all the distractions of it clearly being filmed in the 90s and the immaturity we talked about. So, yeah, I mean, I can see why it did well.
Well, why don't we just go for the jugular, Catherine? And let's talk about that immaturity, because there's definitely, this is a movie that has problems with women.
Yes, for sure. I was reading up a little bit more about it and was shocked to learn that the director, so he was married to this woman, but he met her when she was 12 and he was 29, and then married her when she was 15 and he was presumably 32, which is pretty gross, not gonna lie. And then during the filming of this, he dropped her for the, I think, then 19-year-old Mila Jovovich. Also not great. And so the whole movie kind of does not paint women in a particularly strong light, right? The whole introduction, women are totally missing from the film, except in supporting roles like as a McDonald's cashier, right? And then throughout the film, they're just kind of treated as sex objects, essentially, right? What did you call it before, John? Like the manic pixie dream girl? That was sort of the impression I got from this movie, too. I mean, I think he came up with this idea, you know, his teenage view of the world, his perfect woman, and then brought her onto screen in the form of Lilu. But to me, that indicates a pretty low regard for women in general and just, you know, how can a woman help a man rather than how can a woman be her own person and contribute to the story?
Yeah, and it is unfortunate that all of those sort of, you know, service and supporting roles, right? Like the servers at McDonald's, the stewards on the aircraft and whatnot, they're all women and they're all very heavily sexualized.
Yeah, scantily clad, right? We were talking about the costumes mm-hmm. earlier. They have a lot of skin showing. Except for the diva, which I thought was interesting. In the very first scene we see her, she's basically wearing a burqa. All you can see are her eyes, which I thought was another interesting choice, right? Because generally burqas are not known to be particularly feminist friendly. So yeah, a lot of weird treatment about women. Even though Lilu herself is a cool character, right? I mean, if she'd been given a little bit more to work with, you know, she's strong, she's capable, she's committed. But she just wasn't, and I think Mila Jovovich played her very well. She wasn't given a lot to work with, though, from the script.
No. I mean, on the positive side, if we can find a positive side, she definitely does better than Rachel does with the equivalent scene in this one versus Blade Runner, since we've done these comparisons to Blade Runner.
Yeah. Although Bruce Willis also kisses her without her permission. Now she does point a gun at him, which I appreciated immediately afterwards. And he does realize his mistake. He's like, yeah, I shouldn't have kissed her. But you do get this sense that, you know, all the men are a bit of a lech in this movie, right? And they're just trying to hook up with the sexy lady. They even have that awful sexy saxophone music in the middle. Like I said, I generally like the music in this movie, but that scene was just so much of a trope, right? I did not like that.
Yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of this, I think, that has to do with, you know, what was happening in the 90s in the sense of sort of like the high art anime. And you also have another property from about the same time called Aeon Flux, which got actually turned into a movie about 10 years later, but it was really toned down from the original, you know, MTV version, which had kind of a similar vibe to it. So yeah, not great.
Yeah.
Even if it is a cultural moment, not great.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it. It sort of looks like a cartoon brought to life, but still, you know, it does not paint women in a particularly flattering light. Despite the woman literally being the person who saves the Earth from destruction, right?
Well, exactly. And that, I don't know, the bit at the end seems a little forced too. You know, they know where they're going and the characters, you know, have to do that, but it doesn't feel very natural, at least not to
No,
me.
I agree, right? The whole point is that whatever, like, Bruce Willis has to fall in love with her to save the world. But, I mean, while they seem friendly throughout, I never, you know, felt much tension between them, right? They seem more friends than, like, I'm in love with you. So I agree, it felt sort of forced. It was just, you know, that's how you're supposed to end the movie, so this is how we're going to end the movie.
Yeah. Well, one other thing, in terms of things that place it in the 90s a little bit, is this emphasis on radio.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And yes, and yes, we're talking about this on a podcast and you can't see us and you can only hear us. But I guess I forgive them this because Ruby Rod is just fantastic.
He's amazing. Yeah. Or they are amazing. That was the other thing. So although it did a terrible job treating women, you know, they were pretty forward thinking in having this gender nonconforming person. And it wasn't just him. Like, there were a couple of them, you know, more, you know, we'd maybe call them non-binary today. And that was extremely rare in the 90s. And maybe why I remember it so differently, because that was so unusual to see. And nowadays it's more accepted. But yeah, Ruby Rod was ahead of his time in a lot of ways. And though Prince, I think, was originally supposed to play this role, which would have been great, I think Chris Tucker kind of nailed it. So, you know, no complaints there. He really was the best part of the movie.
It's interesting, right? Because I think, you know, Prince would have done a great job playing himself. Mm-hmm. And Chris Tucker just amped it up to, you know,
to
dialed it up to 11, yeah, or maybe 13.
Yeah.
You know, and that sold it.
Yeah. But it was funny, the emphasis on the radio, right? I mean, yes, you're saying, yes, we're on a podcast, but it's a podcast, not a radio show, right? Like, I'm probably
it's
the only
true.
Person
he has a
left.
Time and everything.
Yeah, he's got a specific time that he plays on the same radio station, right? Like, I might be the only person left on Earth who still listens to the radio, but that's mostly just to CBC to check on the news, right? I'm not really listening to music or shows otherwise.
I don't know. I hear people talk about NPR in a positive light.
Well, right. That's the American CBC. So, but oftentimes they'll just listen to the podcast, right? They don't necessarily listen to it on the radio at a specific time each day. So again, even in 2025, that seems kind of outdated.
That's fair. And I think you also highlighted Zorg. So this I thought was interesting. The idea of, you know, is Zorg sort of a prototypical tech bro?
Oh yeah.
And what I like is this is contemporaneous with Contact. And I remember we had that conversation about Hayden in Contact. You know, is Hayden like a tech bro before there's tech bros type of thing? Well, Zorg definitely has some of the tendencies, right? And I think you picked up on the idea of just wanting to change the world and how doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I was watching that scene where he's talking to the priest and he's describing, you know, his philosophy. And it just gave me, yeah, kind of like Elon Musk vibes, right? I've read a little bit about Elon Musk and it sounds like he wants to like solve the world, but not in any particular way, right? He just wants to get credit for like doing something big. He doesn't actually want to help the world. He just wants to be recognized for the specific thing he did.
Make his mark.
Right. And have everyone, you know, love him and fawn over him for the things that he did. So yes, I mean, electric cars are good for the environment, but it doesn't have to be a Tesla, right? It doesn't have to be exactly the one thing you thought of, right? We should all work together and combine our skills and knowledge to help improve the future. But Zorg and Musk seem to be like, it's my way or the highway. And if you're not going to go along with me, I'd rather destroy the world than save it.
It's true. Although one thing I will say with Zorg is he doesn't seem to be thin skinned at all in the way that sometimes the tech bros are portrayed, right? Like, you know, they want that adulation and that respect and whatnot. Whereas Zorg doesn't seem to care if other people, you know, acknowledge him in quite the same way.
It's a great point. What's his motivation, right? Money, I guess, but why? I don't know. Why does he care? That's a great point. Maybe this is why Gary Oldman didn't like this role.
Yeah, maybe nothing to really sink his teeth into, but that accent and that costume and
just it was pretty great. Yeah,
the mayhem. Yeah,
yeah. He did well with what he was given.
I wonder if not enjoying the role actually helped him,
right? Made him seem more villainous, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah.
Although another point people like to make about this movie is, did you know the villain and the protagonist never meet?
I know. They
Isn't
they
that
come
crazy?
Very close.
Yeah,
it is like. So many other films, you know, have an, you know, they build to a battle or to an argument or something. And yeah, in this one, they never run into each other at all.
No,
it's crazy.
Well, unless the protagonist is the fifth element, then they do interact. But but he and Bruce Willis never cross paths, which is kind of fun. So it's a different way of structuring a movie.
I mean, it's definitely, no one is going to argue that the fifth element is not unique.
I guess. Yeah. Do you think they'd make a movie like this today? What would it look like?
I imagine this would have to be something that a director would make after having a big success. And then this is the studio saying, okay, you get whatever budget you want to do whatever fun artistic thing that you want and just like go. And I can see a director pulling something like this out of their back pocket. How about this ridiculous thing that you would never, ever normally let anybody make?
Well, honestly, though, there's just so much repeats these days. Like all the movies in the movie theater are like sequels or third in a series or something they made 50 years ago and they're redoing it. I would just love to see an original idea come into the theaters because I feel like we haven't had a lot of that recently.
Well said, I think. Is there anything else you want to cover before we go and talk about the ratings?
No, I think that's about it. All right, so coming up here in just a moment, we will give you our ratings for The Fifth Element. Okay, this is the part of the show where we rate the movie in terms of its scientific accuracy, its influence, and how it holds up over time. And nominally, these are rated on a scale of 1 to 5. So, John, what did you give this in terms of scientific accuracy?
Well, since The Fifth Element refuses to be serious when it comes to scientific accuracy, I won't be either. And I will give them a -5,000 based on the temperature of the evil sphere.
Or maybe it's 1,000,000. Who knows?
That's true. There's a duality.
We don't know. Well, I'm a rule follower, so I gave it 1. And though it was pretty bad, I was able to find a few things that they probably didn't intend, but were there anyways to give it some credit. So I will give it a real score, although it is the lowest one a rule following person could give. Okay, what about its influence? How do you think it's influenced society over the past, 28 years?
So this one, I went middle of the road. I feel like this is something that was so original and bright and loud and all these things in the 90s that it just couldn't help but be noticed. And it had a good box office. And it's kept up as a cult classic. And some of the images from the movie, you know, really were burned into the cultural zeitgeist. At the same time, aside from, you know, that little shot of adrenaline, I don't feel like its influence really persisted. So I can't, you know, really give it more than that middle of the road.
Yeah, I'm in violent agreement. It did make a big splash in the 90s. Like I said, I still remember it. I haven't watched it since 1997, but I remembered seeing it. It made an impression on me. And I think there are bits of it that still come to pass, like Aziz Light, you know, certain phrases and whatnot from the movie that people remember. But overall, it hasn't really changed our culture too much. So I had to give it 3 as well. And then how does it hold up? So this is an almost 30-year-old movie. What did you give it here, John?
So this one, I gave it 1.5 or so. I feel like there are parts of it that were dated at the time it came out. You know, there are parts of it that feel kind of cheap. We know that the science is really ridiculous. They put a lot of elements in it that, I mean, the pneumatic tubes, the smoking, the CDs, there's so many things in the phone book, for goodness sake. There's so many things in here that were on the verge of being outdated or were already on their way out. You know, it has a few neat little predictive things, which is why I don't give it the rule following minimum, but I give it just over the rule following minimum, that 1.5.
I tend to agree with you, John. I gave it a 2. So I wish they'd been more clever about how they saw the future, and it just didn't look like a bright vision of the future from 1997. But I do want to give them credit that it's still fun to watch, right? Like, here we are, you know, I was watching it last night and my daughter was next to me playing on the Nintendo Switch. And then she put the Switch down and she watched the last half with me. So it was enough to engage a modern day 12-year-old. So, you know, it's still fun. It's still a goofy, fun movie to watch. So even though it's very much a 90s movie, you know, you can still have a good time with it. All right. So that's it for The Fifth Element. Any final thoughts?
Well, I'm just thinking, until the next time that we speak to you all, Aziz... Light. Popcorn Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.